Hello, and thanks for listening to the Ordinary Philosophy Podcast. Here, you can listen to interviews and audio renditions of pieces published at Ordinary Philosophy's website, dedicated to philosophy in the public square and the history of ideas that change the world. For more about Ordinary Philosophy, and to see the photographs and the sources and inspiration for each piece, please visit ordinaryphilosophy.com. I'm Amy Cools, creator and editor of Ordinary Philosophy. Episode 91, Remembering Joan of Arc. My fascination with Joan of Arc, born sometime in 1412 and put to death by fire on May 30th, 1431, is long-standing, beginning in my girlhood. Joan, as you likely know, is the French national heroine who fought to remove medieval France from English rule, whose exploits turned the tide and guaranteed France's ultimate victory in the Hundred Years' War. She was the daughter of prosperous peasants in Domremy, France. On a self-proclaimed mission from God to restore French rule to the rightful heir of the House of Valois, she convinced the local baron, military leaders, and eventually the crown prince to put her in charge of the dispirited French army, despite the fact that she was illiterate, militarily inexperienced, and a teenage girl. By the time Joan reached the Dauphin, as the French crown prince was called, the French had long been in the habit of losing battles. Even when they had the upper hand in numbers and defensive position, often because they were unable to cohere as a unified fighting force. French society was still feudal, highly stratified by class, and the army was no exception. Common soldiers were ill-equipped and underused, mistrusted and despised by aristocratic and wealthy knights jealous of their own superior rank. They could not bring themselves to give common soldiers opportunities for a share in the military glories of conquest. So French armies, fractured by class with everyone out for themselves, lost time after time to the more pragmatic and unified English forces. Troops of English longbowmen, for example, were made up of common soldiers highly valued for their strength and skill, and the English army made full use of them, to the detriment of the French. When Joan came along, a peasant in direct communication with Saint Michael the Archangel, patron saint of French knights, she served as the much-needed unifier of French sympathies. Knights and commoners alike were united in their love of her and what she represented, and they began to fight as one, an army made holy and therefore equal. The aristocracy and chivalric order may have been respecters of persons, but the god who called Joan to lead them in their sacred quest was not. Joan also whipped the army into shape, demanding that they train as hard as she did. She banned gambling, swearing, and prostitution from the camps, and required that soldiers attend religious services regularly. These reforms served the double purpose of further unifying soldiers through daily rituals that helped internalize their sense of holy, shared purpose, and of reducing the opportunities for alcoholism, venereal disease, and other ravages of hard living that could weaken her forces. She also prohibited pillaging and raiding, which further unified French sympathies. The common people and the countryside, which had long suffered the predation of marauding English and French soldiers. Once she had raised the siege of Orléans, drove the English from fort after fort, and led the Dauphin to be crowned king at Reims, her hawkish mission fell victim to what she considered dithering and intrigue, and what Charles VII considered diplomacy to save lives and capital. As Joan saw it, aristocrats and corrupt clerics, still jealous of their own social standing and opportunities for power either as leaders in the newly strengthened French order or as secret English collaborators, blocked her next great project to deliver Paris from English control. She relieved her frustration and boredom by leading a series of minor skirmishes against the English, and was finally captured at one of these. she was handed over to an ecclesiastical court, led by French clerics sympathetic to the English cause, so they would try her as a heretic, proving her in league with satanic fiends, as the great English playwright William Shakespeare portrays her in Henry V. This would discredit her godly mission, her power to unite the French, and her assistance to Charles VII's cause, thereby undermining his royal legitimacy. She was burned at the stake in Rouen, having accomplished the first part of her mission, the liberation of Orléans and the coronation of her king, and setting in motion the second part, the complete liberation of France from English rule, at only 19 years old. But it was clear to both French and English that the Holy Court that condemned Joan was really led and manipulated by political actors, not by men of God whose chief concern was to protect the church from heresy. About 20 years after her death, the victorious French king Charles VII, who owed his crown and the reclamation of his kingdom to Joan, was finally reminded of his debt of gratitude by the realization that his hold on power was threatened if his rule was the result of the machinations of a heretic. A trial of rehabilitation and nullification commenced in the mid-1400s, which formally vindicated her and proved to their satisfaction that her mission came from God. Then, almost 500 years after her death, Joan of Arc was proclaimed a saint by the Catholic Church. I was religious as a child and a teenager, and admired her then as a Catholic saint. By my late teens, I had left religious belief behind, but my admiration for her has only grown and deepened over the years. She's become something more to me, more rich, more mysterious, more complex. I think of her now as a native genius, with no other language or context in which to express, to herself or others, her political and military insights than the religion which infused her life and the lives of her country people. And the way she was able to baffle, rebut, and defeat her interrogators at the show trial by those determined to discredit her before burning her at the stake remains a marvel. Her intellect was such that, despite her illiteracy and lack of formal education, she was able to see right through the legal deceptions of her judges and prosecutors, avoiding every trap and pitfall they set for her, turning their attacks and arguments right back on them. In preparation for this anniversary of her death, I've immersed myself in writing and art about Joan. Besides various histories, I've recently reread Mark Twain's historical novel, Personal Recollections of Joan of Arc, which was recommended to me by my devoutly Catholic grandmother. I've read it many times over the last 2 decades. It was Twain's own favorite of all of his novels. He proudly announced that he spent 12 years researching it and 2 years writing it, which he did for no other novel. While his Joan novel is as full of comical scenes and quips as any of his other works, it's a tender book, channeling his love for his own wife and daughters, with much less sarcasm and much more earnest, overtly expressed sorrow and compassion than anything else he ever wrote. His Joan is suffused with the sweetness, purity, and honesty he perceived much of in young girls and too little of in the rest of the world. Twain's ideas about young girls and women are, I think, hypersentimental, naive, even dehumanizing to the extent that his ideal of female virtue did not include the full range of human reason and passion. He, like most in his era, in Joan's time, and in fact, Joan herself, fetishized female virginity. But I love his account of Joan's brave life and tragic death nonetheless. Just as we can be forgivingly fond of the quaint idealizations of our fathers, uncles, and grandfathers of the sweet purity of womanhood while secretly rolling our eyes. Unlike Twain's tender ideal of Victorian-style womanhood and the church's monumental saint, I find the complex, flesh-and-blood Joan, full of marvelous virtues, deep flaws, incredible natural abilities, inexplicable quirks, and ordinary human qualities, much more interesting. I admire her courage, audacity, bravery, energy, savviness, intelligence, trust in her own abilities, and independence of spirit. I'm disturbed and even at times repelled by her single-minded, sometimes bloodthirsty willingness to sacrifice so many human lives for her cause. Her insistence that those things going on in her own mind were the absolute truth and must be believed and obeyed or else. Her absolute allegiance to the divine right of kings as established by male bloodline, especially given that many of the French preferred the less ruthless, less feudal, more legally scrupulous style of English rule, and her hyper-religiosity, which impelled her to write letters calling on others to put Muslims and religious dissenters to the sword. The real Joan is such a compendium of attributes and mysteries that she's become an icon and an inspiration to perhaps the most diverse set of people I can think of. Joan of Arc is a working person's icon. She's a self-made woman who got her start working with her hands in the fields and given very little formal education. But with her own common sense, strong sense of self, and enterprising spirit, she pulled herself up by her bootstraps more quickly and to a greater height than nearly anyone else in history. She began as an illiterate peasant in a feudal society and ended up chief of the armies of France before she even reached 20. And after her death, reached even greater heights as a Catholic saint, a military legend, and France's eternal national hero. Joan of Arc is a religious icon. She claimed an intimate knowledge of the will of God through the voices of his emissaries he sent to her, St. Michael the Archangel, St. Catherine, and St. Margaret. She's a treasured, if difficult, icon for Catholicism. She claimed that God spoke to her directly through heavenly messengers, even as the Church considered itself the divinely appointed sole intercessor between humanity and heaven. Though she presented a challenge to Church hierarchy and to the Pauline conception of women as the silent, submissive inheritors of Eve's great sin, Joan was re-reconciled to the very Church that had condemned her, for a variety of theological as well as, I think history makes clear, political reasons. Re-reconciled because her first formal ecclesiastical examination at Poitiers, to establish the truth of her mission before she was allowed to meet the Dauphin, declared that she was devout, orthodox in religion, a true virgin, and free of deceit. Though she remained passionately loyal to the Church and hated religious dissent, she also embodied the independent spirit that inspired the Protestant Revolution, centered on the conviction that God can, and does, speak directly to us in our hearts and through Scripture. No earthly intercessors required. Joan of Arc is a military icon. She loved fighting and spurned any diplomacy beyond plans to move the English out of France as quickly as possible. Though she initially wept at the sight of soldiers wounded and dead as a result of her aggressive tactic of direct assault, she continued to lead every charge in her favored, necessarily casualty-heavy way. Her rhetoric in letters and speech, though embellished with appeals to Christian forbearance and mercy, was violent, filled with threats to chop off heads and put to the sword all who did not obey the will of God as she proclaimed it to be. She inspired deep and enthusiastic devotion in her soldiers, even in her most hard-bitten, most skeptical generals, and quickly achieved a mythic stature among her country people that even General Douglas MacArthur could only envy. Joan of Arc is a queer icon. She was a cross-dresser who disdained sex with men and who dressed in men's clothes. Her first simple style of male garb was a practical measure for a soldier who needed to move freely and for a woman often surrounded by men in a culture that regarded single women without escort as fair sexual prey. But over time, as she first encountered the delights of elegant, expensive clothing, showered upon her as gifts of admiration and gratitude, she became quite the clothes horse. She saw no problem with this. Medieval sensibilities often conflated holiness and material richness, just as the Old Testament did. and God, his favorites, angels, and saints, were almost invariably portrayed in the richest finery. But her enemies mocked her adopted style of wearing silken hose and richly embellished garments in fine fabrics as proof that she was as vain, conceited, and driven by lust for personal fame and riches as they had always said. Another reputed French visionary, a young shepherd boy being groomed as Joan's more convenient, less pugnacious replacement as saintly advisor to the king, blamed her capture on her having fallen prey to vanity and luxury. They claimed that she was captured because of her finery, pulled off her horse by the fancy little cape she had grown fond of wearing. Joan of Arc is an art and fashion icon. Her exploits, her cross-dressing, her independence of spirit, and her short hair inspired centuries of creative people to capture this wondrously unique individual on canvas, in brass and wood, and in textiles. And songs, poems, stories, films, plays, and countless other forms of creative expression emphasize this, that, or the other facet of her varied and mysterious character. And the Joan style, French-invented bobbed haircut of the 1920s, the same decade which saw Joan's canonization and women's obtaining the full legal right to vote in the United States and Britain, it took France another 20 years, became a potent symbol, a public declaration that each cropped head recognized that Joan of Arc is the feminist icon par excellence. She bested men in daring and stamina on the battlefield, in intellect time after time in the courtroom, in keeping her own counsel and determining her own destiny despite opposition from family, church, and society, in self-preservation from her would-be prison rapists, and in the courage she displayed on the day of her death. And yet, as she charmingly boasted near the beginning of her final trials, she was confident that she was a better seamstress and spinner than just about any other woman. She wore armor, pretty dresses, rough men's clothes, and over-the-top finery as it suited her. She sang, rode horses, adventures, communed with God and angels, told men and other women what to do, and drove thousands of people to distraction, wondering what to make of this extraordinary, inspiring, difficult, inexplicable, and unforgettable person. It's my dream and my plan, as soon as resources and time allow, to follow the life and ideas of Joan of Arc in France. Stay tuned, though it might be a while, but in the meantime, see the written version of this piece for great sources, for learning more about this marvelous woman, for photographs and art and great other links. Ordinary Philosophy's website and podcast are independent and ad-free, and depend on support from patrons and listeners like you. To find out more about how you can contribute to Ordinary Philosophy, please visit the Subscribe, Submit, and Support page today. And if you enjoy what you read and hear at Ordinary Philosophy, please share it with those you believe will enjoy it too, and take a moment to rate and review this podcast on iTunes. And thanks, as always, for listening.